reliable power. That's, you know, I think that's every community's dream. We hope to make it a reality, and sooner rather than later.
ADAC residents have high hopes for hydropower. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, legacy cleanup at the Red Devil Mine.
BLM has had some mixed cleanups through time, never really done a complete investigation.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Ensuring our youth understand the need for workplace safety will help prevent injuries. If your middle or high school is interested in having a youth representative speak to your students about workplace safety, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health Youth Safety at 1-800-656-4972. This message is sponsored by Alaska Labor Standards and Safety.
After 15 years of development, ATCA is set to dedicate its hydropower plant this fall. Now, another Aleutian community is hoping to turn its abundant water supply into energy. KUCB's Alexander Gutierrez has this story from ADAC.
Even in a region known for being wet, ADAC stands out. With 263 days of precipitation a year, it's the rainiest city in Alaska. Streams cut through every hill, and there are more lakes than there are people. On a tour of ADAC's dams and pipes, city manager Layden Lockett tells me that the water flow is so powerful that they need to depressurize it before delivering it to homes for human consumption. If they didn't, the city's pipes would explode.
You know that that guy in 2002 who shot the Trans-Alaska pipeline? Mm-hmm. If he were to put a bullet into this pipeline, it would rupture and go off like a big bomb. I mean, that's how pressurized this thing is.
Now the city wants to harness that power. This August, ADAC received a grant from the Department of Commerce to study the possibility of hydropower on the island. It's a big move for ADAC. The 150-person community was struggling to keep its lights on not long ago. In 2008, the city suffered from major outages, and a now-defunct fishing company skipped out on a $500,000 bill. The state eventually handed over the city's authority to run the island's World War II-era diesel power plant to Native Corporation TDX. TDX absorbed the losses and brought the island power security, but also doubled rates in the process. Electric bills can cost a family up to $600 a month, and Lockett doesn't see any way to bring them down using the current equipment.
It's, it doesn't take long to pencil out that we have to do something. I mean, even if we wind up with new diesel generation, we kind of have to do something, and now's as good a time as any to really try to invest in that.
That's where a city-owned hydro plant comes in. The idea is to bring electric rates down about 75%, all while using a local renewable energy source. Since ADAC already has dams built from its old days as a naval base, the city would mainly have to focus on setting up turbines and improving its electrical grid. The Department of Commerce analysis is meant to give them a better sense of what that involves and how fast it can be done. While the federal government is footing most of the bill for the study, ADAC is still contributing $40,000, or 4% of the city's annual budget. They also spent $30,000 last year on dam inspections. These aren't insignificant commitments for the small community. But with fuel being so expensive in rural parts of the state, Lockett says that the investment could pay off.
Cheap, reliable power, I think that's every community's dream. We hope to make it a reality, and sooner rather than later.
The city would like to have the study done by next year and aims to secure financing for the project by 2013. In ADAC, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
A newly formed chapter of a national nonprofit organization is taking a group of Alaska veterans to visit the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Ohio-based Honor Flight Network sponsors trips for veterans of World War II, the Korean and Vietnam Wars, to visit memorials in the nation's capital. The organization has taken over 80,000 vets from across the country to Washington, D.C. since 2005, but there's never been a flight from Alaska. Julie Engford, director of Festival Fairbanks, which runs a local Veterans Day event, says there's been interest in starting an Alaska chapter, but logistics and funding have been a barrier.
A couple years ago, when we called them to express interest, they told us how a lot of times tickets are donated from Southwest Airlines. And consequently, no Alaskan World War II veterans have ever taken an honor flight because they would have to pay their own way.
Engfer says Festival Fairbanks has worked with Alaska veterans groups to join the Honor Flight Network. She says support from the Oregon branch of Honor Flight and Alaska Airlines has helped start an Alaska chapter.
Alaska Airlines has given us tickets to take our inaugural flight. We will be meeting up with this group from Oregon, and Southwest Airlines is also supporting us from there. So this has significantly helped our budget. Our original budget was over $17,000 to take four veterans and guardians. All of them, for the very first time in their lives, are going to see this World War II memorial.
Engfer says the group of four Alaskan World War II veterans traveling out to Washington, D.C. at the end of September includes a Navy veteran from Fairbanks and vets representing the Army, Marines, and Air Force from Anchorage. A fundraising event to support Alaska's Honor Flight chapter is happening Friday at the Fairbanks Elks Lodge. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Cleanup at the Red Devil mine site is getting special attention from the state's administration. Attorney General Mike Garrity, under the direction of the governor, is requesting that the old Mercury mine site be put on the national priorities list. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
The Red Devil mine opened in 1933 and over nearly four decades extracted over 2.5 million pounds of mercury. The mine is located on a small tributary of the Middle Kuskokwim near the village of Red Devil. In a letter to the Environmental Protection Agency, Garrity wrote that the BLM, quote, has been unwilling to consider state comments and recommendations. He further wrote that the BLM has not fulfilled its responsibility to properly assess and mitigate impacts from the mine site. Garrity stated that putting the mine on the national priorities list will provide consistent funding and will ensure that the state's concerns are factored into cleanup efforts.
BLM has had some mixed cleanups through time, never really done a complete investigation.
Jennifer Roberts is the Federal Facilities Program Manager for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. She says the state's concerns go back nearly 10 years. In 2006, the state asked for a two-party agreement so they could be more involved in the process, which they found to be unsatisfactory. But BLM denied it, according to Roberts.
Apparently, there are some internal issues between BLM, Department of Interior, and EPA up at headquarters level that, for lack of better terminology, they seem to have some policy differences.
She says those differences have delayed the cleanup project. According to Roberts, BLM did a partial removal of contaminated soil and built a waste disposal area at the mine site, but the state did not agree with how it was done and where it was placed.
What we were concerned about was that they didn't go far enough.
Roberts says there is still mercury in the subsurface soil.
And we have no idea really how those will move through and where those might end up. And our concern, of course, is always if it would get into the Red Devil Creek or into the Kuskokwim River.
Fish in the creek are contaminated. Those findings came out this spring when BLM started meetings with villages along the river to discuss their sampling projects, which found that mercury and arsenic are being released into the creek. BLM has also found contamination in sediment in the Kuskokwim near the mouth of the creek. The state has issued a warning to residents not to collect subsistence foods near the old mine site. This warning followed a more general one for pregnant women and young children along the river who are cautioned against eating a lot of larger-sized pike and lush fish, predators that can accumulate mercury over many years. The Kuskokwim watershed is within a highly mineralized area known as the Mercury Belt and has naturally occurring mercury and arsenic. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
For the past 5 years, Sand Point has been quietly cleaning up a toxic spill at its old quarry. Now that project is finally winding down, KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports.
By December, Sand Point should be able to close the book on the cleanup at the abandoned quarry. That's when the last few barrels of hazardous waste will be put on a boat and shipped out of town, according to city manager Paul Day.
And when I say hazardous, it wasn't nuclear, or it wasn't, it's just stuff that we cannot dispose of locally. We can't burn it. So it had to be shipped out of Sand Point for disposal.
The city never intended for its quarry to become a public dumping ground, but it was supposed to be the site of a city program to junk old cars. To do that, they needed to drain the used oil in antifreeze. Sandpoint stored that liquid in drums, which were set on top of impermeable liners to protect the soil.
That's where we dropped the ball. We left them sitting on that liner for a number of years, 4 or 5 years. We're going to get around to getting those drums cleaned up and out of town one of these days. Well, that just never happened.
The liners didn't hold, and the drums started leaking toxic liquid into the ground. And the dumping continued. Private citizens snuck into the quarry to use the drums, and local marine vessels joined in, offloading dirty oil. By the time the Department of Environmental Conservation started investigating, they were dealing with 120 leaky drums. They ordered Sandpoint to clean up the site in 2007. John Brown with the DEC says the pollution wasn't nearly as bad as it could have been.
The city's, you know, drinking water facility is, or storage facility is just, you know, down the road, you know, almost a mile. That we wanted to make sure that there was, you know, no impacts to the water quality there. And the city had already been testing a lot for those types of things anyway, so the city was on top of that.
Day says the contamination was limited to a small area.
The actual site that had the drum problem was smaller than a half a football field. Besides the drums that were cleaned up, all the material, all the contaminated gravels, but all the soil that we could scrape up has now been put onto a liner and covered.
The contaminated soil should break down safely in those new containers. The city was also able to recycle a significant amount of used oil to heat municipal buildings. Brown says the DEC isn't going to fine the city for the pollution, but they have made Sandpoint pay for the entire cleanup, including site visits and testing by the DEC. Over the past 5 years, that's come to about $200,000. Sandpoint co-owns the quarry with the Shemigan Corporation, but Day says the city decided early on not to ask them to split the bills. The car disposal program was the city's idea, and Day says it was in the public's interest to clean the site as fast as possible. Sandpoint has paid off the cleanup as costs arose, so they won't take on any debt as a result. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, describing a feathered dinosaur that once roamed Denali National Park.
You think of a pot-bellied, bipedal, knuckle-dragging, plant-eating dinosaur, and you've got it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Federal Aviation Administration setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
A recent discovery of an enormous ancient footprint in Denali National Park is being seen as another indication of how busy the Alaskan landscape was, with prehistoric animals coming and going for seasonal food hunting. Anthony Fiorillo is the curator of earth sciences at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science in Dallas. He says the first dinosaur print in Denali was found in 2005. He says that discovery, now on display at the Muri Science and Learning Center, was the tip of the iceberg in terms of realizing how much dinosaur activity Denali once contained.
Every year we've been going up there, and every year we've been documenting dozens or hundreds of new localities. So at this point, it's safe to say that Denali National Park actually has thousands of dinosaur footprints throughout part of the park.
Fiorillo says the new find, a therizinosaur track, was beyond Fang Mountain.
Once you cross the Sanctuary River and looked to the south side of the road, you would be looking all the way out to the Toklat Camp, and even a little bit beyond that, you would be driving through some of the best dinosaur country anywhere.
Fiorillo says the feathered therizinosaur was related to both Tyrannosaurus rex and the chickadee, with 4 forward-facing toes and peg-like teeth suited for chomping vegetation.
Another feature of therizinosaurs is that they had on their front, off their hands, these very long claws. And so if you put all that together, you've got four forward-facing toes, these almost knuckle-dragging long claws on the hands, and a mouth that seems to be adapted for eating vegetation. And they also are very wide-bodied, almost cow-like, if you will. And so that you think of a pot-bellied, bipedal, knuckle-dragging, plant-eating dinosaur, and you've got it. Not exactly a flattering image, but that's what we think we're talking about.
How much would a therizinosaur have weighed?
Well, certainly the big ones would have weighed similar to what a Tyrannosaurus would weigh, which is on the order of a few tons.
T-Rex had little tiny arms, but these guys had big long arms, it sounds like.
With big long claws, right.
How long ago were they in Alaska?
Well, the track that we described in our paper is now even better supported because the discovery of this summer was that we found several more tracks that we can attribute to this animal. So it's not just one therizinosaur being a pogo stick landing once and we never see it again. We, in fact, actually have several of these tracks now. In Alaska, we have our best evidence suggests that these dinosaurs lived somewhere between 69 and 70 million years ago.
Fiorillo says the therizinosaur track will be on display with other Alaska dinosaur finds in the Fossil Hall at the new Perot Museum of Nature and Science in Dallas. The opening is slated for December. Pictures are at our website, alaskapublic.org. Migratory shorebirds in the Arctic have been gearing up over the last month for the long migration south. There's no telling how many will take to the air from Alaska, but one scientist will have a chance to find out starting next year. KUAC's Emily Schwing has more.
University of Alaska Anchorage Assistant Professor Audrey Taylor studies shorebirds and their migration patterns to and from Alaska. She says there's a long list of birds that fly north to the state's Arctic coastal lagoons. They spend most of the summer feeding along the Bering Sea coast.
Mostly western sandpipers, semi-palmated sandpipers, dunlin. I work on black turnstones, and so there's some of those up there. So there'd be bar-tailed godwits. There would be long-billed dowitchers, redneck phalaropes, and some red phalaropes.
Despite the long list, Taylor says no one really knows how many birds might pass overhead as they head south again this fall.
That's a very good question, and that actually is the subject of a grant that I just received through the National Park Service to do surveys next summer on those coastal lagoons to try to figure out, you know, what are, relatively speaking, are we talking about thousands of birds, millions of birds? What's the scope? So it could be anywhere from several hundred thousand to several million. It's really difficult to tell.
Some birds, like the bar-tailed godwit, fly nonstop over open water as far south as Australia and New Zealand. But before they take flight, they load up on as much fat and protein as they can in the coastal lagoons, which are sheltered areas with very little wave action. That's why Taylor is concerned about oil and gas development in the region.
Where if there were some kind of contaminant spill or oil spill, I would expect that oil would also come into those areas and potentially get kind of stuck. And there have been some studies looking at how birds distinguish oiled water versus non-oiled water. And adult birds seem to be okay about deciding when something's too contaminated to feed or land in. But the juvenile birds, they have more trouble telling whether something is clean water or not.
Aerial surveys and species composition work on the ground will start next summer. Taylor says the work will create better baseline data to track both reproductive and survival rates as birds fly to and from the state. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is seeking more participants for the Local Environmental Observer Program, which collects observations from around the state about unusual or extreme environmental occurrences and changes. Since the program began in January, 130 tribal environmental leaders from 85 communities around the state have registered as LEOs. ANTHC's Director for the Center for Climate and Health, Mike Brubaker, says the LEOs serve as central points for collecting observations from everyone in the community.
In some places in the circumpolar north, changes are happening very rapidly, and you, its elders have a long-term perspective on what's going on and what's unusual and what's important. But even young people have seen sometimes some pretty amazing changes or observed new occurrences, and they're also engaging in their environment in different ways than the elders are.
Leos are interested in everything from sightings of invasive species, unusual birds, insects, or other wildlife, and changes in wildlife behavior and health, to extreme weather events or extreme erosion. The Leos collect the information, then submit them to a central database where they are listed on the program's website. Brubaker explains that forming a communal database helps connect Leos with topic experts.
There was an interesting posting that came from Southeast about hairlessness, or not hairlessness, but loss of hair in deer. And that resulted in some really interesting conversations about the types of causes of hair loss in deer, not only in Alaska and in Southeast, but in BC.
They can also see if there are any larger environmental trends going on, connect affected communities, and raise awareness about different topics.
We think that's really important within the tribal health system, because sometimes it results in concerns about water safety or security or food safety and security. We learn things about risk for injury, for example, the seasonality of when falls through ice are occurring.
All of the reports are documented on the program's website. You can click on a map of Alaska, and it will tell you what observations were made in different areas each month. The easiest way to find the site is by Googling Alaska Leo. Overall catch and effort was down again this summer for Southeast Dungeness crab fishery, which closed in mid-August. That's according to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's preliminary totals, which were made available last week. Biologist Adam Messmer says 144 permit holders had landed 1.8 million pounds of crab during the two-month season. That's a couple hundred thousand pounds less than last summer.
Last year was a pretty low year all around, but last summer we harvested 2 million pounds, but there was 162 permits. So efforts kind of have been going down over the last couple of years.
The Dungy harvest has been on the decline for several years, and a number of crabbers have shifted their effort to salmon fishing. Crabbers remain concerned about the impact of the growing population of sea otters, which prey on shellfish. While Fleet pulled fewer pots this summer, Messmer says the average amount of crab in each pot was up to nearly 6 pounds. That's compared to 5.3 pounds last season. Prices were up as well. Dungy's averaged $2.55 a pound this summer, which is a quarter more than in 2011. That means this summer's catch was worth roughly $4.6 million to crabbers, which is several hundred thousand dollars higher than last summer. The Southeast Dungy season resumes in October and lasts another 2 months for most of the region.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The University of Alaska Southeast has received a $50,000 memorial gift from the estate of Emma G. Widmark, given in the name of her father, Dr. Alfred E. Widmark. UAS Director of Development and Alumni Relations Lynn Johnson says the gift will be used to permanently endow the university's Alaska Native and Rural Student Center.
The center provides, they help them register for classes, they give them career counseling, they make sure academically that they're taking the right classes. I think it's one of our strengths here.
Johnson says the donation is believed to be just the second memorial gift given to UAS since the school was established. Alfred Widmark was a Tlingit, born in Haines in 1904. He served in the Alaska State Legislature from 1961 to 62. He also served as mayor of Klawak, president of the Alaska Native Brotherhood Grand Camp, and as an executive committee member of both the Grand Camp and the Tlingit and Haida Central Council. He was an ANB representative to and vice president of the National Congress of American Indians and a member of the Sea Alaska Corporation Board of Directors. Widmark received an honorary Doctorate of Humanities from the University of Alaska Southeast in 1971. Emma Widmark passed away in 2008. Johnson says UAS first learned of the donation from the Widmark estate in June. The Democratic Party announced that the person who won Anchorage's Democratic House District 13 primary has withdrawn, and they have appointed someone new. The party announced that Kay Rollison will replace Hal Gazaway in the Muldoon neighborhood last week. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
The replacement for Hal Gazaway kicked off her campaign at El Rodeo Restaurant in the Muldoon neighborhood. Surrounded by tortilla chip-laden tables, she explained why she's running.
Well, I'm running because, unfortunately, Hal stepped down, and I didn't vote for Gabrielle Ledoux the last time, and I don't want to vote for her this time.
61-year-old Kay Rollison says she came to Alaska from her home state of South Carolina in 1975 to work in the construction industry. She started out working on the pipeline in Fairbanks, where she was employed by the Culinary Hotel and Restaurant Union. In 2006, she ran for lieutenant governor and lost. Over the years, she's worked in labor management and contracting in the construction industry, specializing in civil rights and affirmative action. She says her work experience will be useful if voters send her to Juneau.
I worked on the pipeline for unions, for construction companies. I moved from that into a consulting business, worked for construction projects, kind of as a liaison between the different contractors, state, fed, native corporations, locals.
If she's elected, Rollison says she'll focus on making sure Muldoon gets funding from the state to pay for the infrastructure needed as the nearby base and the neighborhood expand. She says she's pro-choice, supports gay rights, and dislikes the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling. The Democratic Party released a statement from Gazaway saying he withdrew because he could not comply with the candidate disclosure rules without compromising some of his client's attorney-client confidentiality. Gazaway was unopposed in Tuesday's primary and won with 360 votes. Republican candidate Gabrielle Ledoux also ran unopposed and won with 574 votes. Rollison will face Ledoux in the general election November 6th. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Angela Denning-Barnes in Bethel, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create 1,500 jobs during the 4 years of construction and spur thousands more after completion by creating access to affordable land for commercial, industrial, and residential use. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.